You're listening to this week's podcast by the Not-So-Famous Sports Reporters with your hosts, Austin Klein and Nicholas Jarvin.
Hey guys, this is host Austin Klein. I'm here with your co-host, Nicholas Jarvin. How you doing today, Nick?
Pretty good. How about you, Klein?
I'm doing pretty well myself. I wanted to start off today talking a little bit about the song we played at the beginning of the podcast. For those of you who don't know or are not familiar with the MVP baseball series, that song is Walkie Talkie Man by Stereogram. It was actually featured on the soundtrack of one of my favorite baseball games, MVP Baseball 2004. I had that game for the original Xbox, and I'm really hoping that EA Sports would bring that series back. I know Nick has a little word on that.
Yeah, there's nothing for Xbox this year except RBI Baseball. RBI Baseball is a good game, but it's like an arcade game. It's like a secondary game. They need something that's good that can rival against the show, too. But, yeah, MVP Baseball was great. It was like years ahead of other games, and I think it was one of the best sports games ever, especially considering the time period it was in. And I did really good with the Dynasty mode in that. We won with the Red Sox and, who was the other? Oh, the Rangers. I did it with the Rangers, and we won the World Series. Took 7 games, though, with the Rangers. So, it's crazy.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It was way ahead of its time period. It had some great features that the show kind of came in and copied off EA after they stopped making the game, but yeah, RBI Baseball, I wasn't alive for the original RBI Baseballs, but from what I hear from my dad and stuff, they did a pretty good job repeating it and remaking the authenticity of the classic game.
Feel. It's a fun game, and it's fun to play, like, just for 20 minutes, half hour, but after that it can kind of get long and kind of boring even, but the thing is that they just need an in-depth baseball game, especially for a big console like Xbox. MLB needs to reach out to its fans. That's how a lot of sports get their fans nowadays. A lot of kids are on Xbox or PlayStation most of their day, especially during the summer even, and they play these games, and when you're lacking a whole console, it even hurts the impact it has on whether or not kids are going to come and support baseball and be fans of baseball when they're older. So I think it's important from that standpoint that they get a new game in too. And just the fact that I think MVP Baseball would be the right choice for a game because EA Sports has experience and they're a good developer, and I think they could make a good game and update the features. Because in MVP 05, they actually had a thing where you could build your own stadium and go off that, and it was kind of like an owner mode along with on top of the fact that you were a GM, like a dynasty mode, but it was an owner mode. You can make your own park and everything, which I enjoyed a lot. I played the heck out of that game, and it was just a really fun game, and I think they could add on to that, do something like that. And then, you know, a popular feature in a lot of games today is like the ultimate team. They could do something like that. Well, they could do an ultimate team because they are EA Sports, so they could just name it ultimate team and do something along the lines of having the major leaguers be like the gold guys, and minor leaguers being the silver and bronze players. And I think they could really work a good game into the Xbox, and I hope they make one, because as an owner of an Xbox right now, I feel awfully left out, because the show has had some pretty good improvements over the years, and it's a pretty realistic and in-depth game from what I've heard.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't know, the Ultimate Team he was referring to is big on FIFA games. You know, if you haven't played it, I definitely recommend you checking that out. They also have it on the NHL games and the Madden games, but definitely best on FIFA. But I also agree, yeah, that Xbox needs a game, and MVP, it'd be the perfect time for EA to come back. It's 2K, the 2K games, 2K Sports games. Basketball is the best choice, but they made the baseball game for 8 years.
And well, I hate 2K. Just put my word on that.
It was not very quality.
No, I just not a big 2K fan. I never have been. I've always thought their graphics are really bad. And playing 2K the year after they stopped MVP Baseball, just like the little things, like the way the players their stances when they went up to hit just seemed unrealistic to me and stuff. But I think EA Sports will probably come back if I had to make a prediction on that, and I think they're going to do a good job on that. And the Ultimate Team can really help help out a lot, too, because it'll get kids to know more players and stuff. Because I know watching the World Cup, I recognized a few players that I probably wouldn't have recognized because I had them on my Ultimate Team, you know, because I'm not a diehard soccer fan, you know, but watching the World Cup, it was pretty cool to just see the guys and know that I've played up with them on Ultimate Team.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, like I said, I think it'd be a perfect time for EA to make a comeback. 2K didn't resend licensing with the MLB, so I think that's about it. That was our little spiel on the not having an MLB game for the Xbox. So today we're going to cover a couple topics in sports this week. We're going to talk about the MLB Hall of Fame inductions. We're going to talk about a little bit of trade deadline. You know, we're almost there with the MLB trade deadline at the end of this month, a couple more days. And hometown Detroit fans, we're going to talk about what we think they could do to improve their team down the stretch, hopefully winning World Series this year.
You get to hear me about the prospects, too, which ones I think we should keep and trade. So that'll be interesting.
Yeah, we've been really close the last couple of years, and I think a couple missing pieces. The awful bullpen right now.
Well, Story helps. He's better than Barrios last year. See, the thing about Dombrowski is he always gets, he always makes a great trade every trade deadline, I think. Last year it was Iglesias. In 2012, he got Sanchez and Infante. In 2011, that was the best year, I think. He got Bedemit, who didn't do so well in the past, but I think down the stretch of the regular season, what he helped the Tigers do was very not mentioned. Nobody really mentioned it, and he kind of got overshadowed, but I think he helped the Tigers a lot. 2011. Then, of course, the big acquisitions of Fister and Delmon Young. It's too bad, looking at all the trades that are happening right now, it's too bad that the Tigers got the return they got on Fister, because I think they could have gotten Rendon or Drew Storen, and Drew Storen could have really helped the bullpen out, and Rendon's a good power hitter, he could have found a spot, but I think they could have got a better return than just basically Robbie Ray. I mean, Ian Cole's pretty good too, but Robbie Ray is basically like the centerpiece of the deal, because you don't trade a number three starter for a reliever. That's not what you're aiming to get. Yeah. And then Lombardozzi, that was a really silly trade. Alex Gonzalez got the walk-off single on opening day, and that was it. I think he got like half of his hits on opening day. He only got four hits with the Tigers, and half of them were on opening day. They were big hits, but, you know, you can't have that. But, yeah, basically got a backup and a middle reliever, which, you know, those are key parts to the team, but when you're trading a guy like Doug Fister, it's important that you get a little more. Not that Robbie Ray's going to be bad or anything, but he's been struggling a little bit in AAA, and it's really making this trade look bad. But Dombrowski made a great trade in the Soria trade, even though he had to give up Jake Thompson and Knebel, who both will probably do pretty good in Texas, I think. But it's still earlier on in the stages for Thompson's career. He's only in single A. But I like the Soria trade a lot better than the Varus trade. The Varus trade didn't really even help the bullpen much last year.
He does.
But Soria trade, well.
Yeah, it was a, like I said, he makes great trades, and we'll hear a little bit more on that later about what Nick thinks the Tigers should do leading up to this deadline in a couple days.
Soria, yeah.
And also we're going to cover a little bit of preseason NFL training camp, because, you know, a lot of you have been very disappointed. Some of you waited 30 or 40 years to see a Lions winning season, and we've had a few in there.
Should have drafted no fly zone this year, man.
We've had a couple playoff runs, but yeah, we'll cover a little bit of what we've been seeing in the training camp. So we'll looking forward to that later on the show. All right, so our first topic of conversation today is going to be about the 2014 Major League Baseball Hall of Fame inductions. Just a few quick notes on this year's inductions. The number is kind of high. There were six this year inducted, and there hasn't been six since 1999. And that's excluding the 2006 season, when they included the players and managers from the Negro League as well. And that year they had 18. So, but this year they had three players and three managers. The players, of course, being Frank Thomas, Tom Glavine, and Greg Maddux. And the managers were Bobby Cox, Tony La Russa, and Joe Torre. And I think LaRusso must have figured a good time to go out, you know, after a season in 2011, of course, winning the World Series with the Cardinals that year.
Yeah, it was a good time to go out. The only time I've ever seen him smile on the baseball field was when David Freese hit that triple and Pujols and Bergman came home and scored. I remember watching that game. That was a crazy game. Back and forth, back and forth. That was one of the best World Series games I've ever been alive to watch. But I'm going to start off with talking about a little bit about the players who got inducted. All first ballot Hall of Famers, which was pretty cool. I think they all deserved it. Frank Thomas, who ended with 521 career homers, was a designated hitter and a first baseman during his career, and he won the MVP in 93 and 94, and he had a career WAR. I don't know, a lot of people like to follow this stat. He had a career WAR of 73.7, so that's a pretty interesting fact about him. But Thomas obviously deserves it. The 500 homers pretty much was like an automatic shoo-in, but you know, he had a good career all around, though. He's a good hitter. He had 2,468 hits and 495 doubles, which is pretty impressive to me, too, and managed to hit over 300. And, you know, Thomas was a good player, and this might even help open up a little bit to DHs in the Hall of Fame. Thomas was a first baseman for the majority of his career, but he's definitely a DH for a decent amount of time, especially during the end of his career. He had a really good year as a DH in Oakland, actually, which was really surprising after he feuded with Ken Williams out of Chicago, which was pretty surprising to see Frank Thomas leave the White Sox, extend his career. But he had 39 homers in 2006, which was just 2 years before he retired, so the guy dominated his whole career. He deserves it. But the big thing about Frank Thomas and why I brought him up first is because Thomas was put in the steroid era, but he was obviously pretty clean from what we can tell, and from what, you know, nobody's ever accused him of taking steroids or any form of that. But it brings up the question as to why some guys will get in and some guys won't. Because Jeff Bagwell was an NL, you know, equivalent almost, not quite, because they weren't the same type of player. But he's a first baseman, so it's easy to compare him. They played the same position. And he was a great first baseman in the National League. And some people have held him out or wanted him held out because there's suspicions that he took steroids. It's not even a, no evidence or anything along that line. But it just raises the question as to me, how are these guys, you know, how do they decide, the writers, because they're the ones who vote, how do they decide who's clean and who's not? Because their system's pretty weird to me. Because Frank Thomas deserved it. He had his moment. He got very emotional during the speech. Deserved it. Like I've said, he really, you know, I got to watch him play. This is, you know, now I'm at the age where I got to see some of the guys at the end of their career playing, and, you know, he was always just a polarizing figure at the plate. And it's just sad that Jeff Bagwell, you know, a guy who should be in the Hall of Fame, doesn't get that chance yet because there's some suspicions of him taking steroids. But anyways, moving on to the pitchers that got in, we got Tom Glavine and John Smoltz, who were part of the same rotation for most of their career. They formed one of the best rotations of all time, pretty much, in Atlanta for a while. And Glavine ended up playing for the Mets for a while, and Maddox had some good years with the Cubs, too. But Glavine had 305 wins. He stuck around long enough to get the 300 mark. But, I mean, he had a really good career. And, you know, both of these guys were kind of doubted upon at the beginning of their careers, and they ended up carving Hall of Fame careers out of what they had. At one point, Tom Glavine won 20 games three straight years, which is pretty impressive.
It's incredible.
Yeah, even though wins is not exactly, you know, the best stat in the world to go by, but it means a little bit of something. But Glavine and Maddox are both amazing. Maddox, I think, was the better pitcher of the two. Because Maddox just could carve hitters. It's just, what Maddox could do is pretty amazing to me. I've heard some crazy stories about him. And Maddox seems like he's a pretty boring guy, but if you watched any of the interviews or stuff during Hall of Fame week, you could see that he is actually a pretty funny guy and had a pretty good personality. But Maddox, he pitched really well throughout his career, and
did great in the World Series, too. In the five starts he had in the World Series, he had an ERA of 2.09. But Maddux won 355 games, which is really impressive because he only pitched, I think, a year or two longer than Glavine, and he got 50 more wins. Even at the end of his career, Maddux wasn't as dominant. He dominated in the early 2000s and the 90s for his heyday. But both of their careers are pretty amazing, and the more amazing thing is the fact that John Smoltz will probably join them next year, and they were all in the same rotation. Smoltz deserves it, too, because he has a lot of saves, too. He's a good reliever and starter. So that's pretty cool. And then to hop on the managers for a minute, I always think it's pretty funny because Joe Torre and Bobby Cox both retired after 2010, and La Russa did after 2009. And Joe Torre is actually, you could argue, probably the closest ever to getting into the Hall of Fame as both a manager and a player, because he had a pretty outstanding playing career, too. And he deserved it, because, you know, those Yankee teams of the late 90s and early 2000s are classics, and it does take a little bit to deal with the boss and stuff, and have to deal with the New York media and stuff. It's hard to be a manager there. And Torre was a really good manager. He just falls in line of good Yankee managers that they've had over the years. And then Bobby Cox, the career ejections leader, how could you not include him? He was a great manager anyways, even with his fiery personality. And then Tony La Russa is probably one of the greatest strategists ever in the game. So all three were deserving, and all three went out at the same time. And as a Detroiter, I can only hope that Jimmy Whelan joins him soon. Even though he doesn't have quite the impressive resume that they all have, he's still a pretty impressive manager. And now all the legendary managers are retired for the most part, so it's pretty crazy. But one thing I wanted to bring up, and I want your take on this too, is before or during the week, before you know the players got to give their speeches on Sunday, the Hall of Fame announced that the eligibility for players would go from 15 to 10 years. And a lot of people think this is a ploy to get the steroid guys off the ballot quicker. And also another important thing to note is that guys like Alan Trammell and stuff, they all get grandfathered in, so they get 15 years eligible. What do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, like you said, it might be a ploy to get some of the steroid, well, the potential steroid users off the ballot.
Well, some of them are for sure. Barry Bonds is for sure.
Yeah.
Someone's pretty close.
But I'll touch on Barry Bonds really quick. Besides his whole steroid scandal, he's a great hitter.
Yeah, he's a Hall of Famer without steroids, before steroids. Any way you chop it, look at it. I've seen some statistics of him, and he wasn't quite the home run hitter he was after the steroids, but he was pretty much a Hall of Fame player on his way to being a Hall of Fame player even before he started juicing. And another thing is that I know it's not a good excuse, but one argument one could make is that a lot of the players in the 90s were juicing, so even though, you know, Bonds may have been juicing or Clemens might have been juicing, they still stood up out in the pack. And Tony La Russa made a comment about it, and he said that he thinks that they should get in, have an asterisk by their name in the Hall of Fame, which is pretty interesting considering La Russa managed, you know, Mark McGuire and stuff, so it's a pretty statement by him.
Yeah, I don't have a problem. I definitely don't have a problem with the shortening of the time period that they're eligible to get voted in, except for that fact. But, you know, I mean, I think it was an okay move, just because if you're a Hall of Famer, you're a Hall of Famer, whether it takes you 10 years or 15 years, I believe. But one last thing on the great manager, Tony La Russa. You know, he won four Manager of the Year awards, 04, 05, 06, and 2009. And
even win one for the amazing comeback in 2011.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not a big Cardinals fan because, you know, they won the 06 series of the hometown Detroit Tigers. But one less, you know, the Cardinals didn't have a great year that year. They finished 83-78, and that's the worst regular season record by any eventual World Series champion. So he definitely did. He must have got his team fired up with his, you know, his ability they didn't have a great year, and they went all the way to the World Series and won it. So
yeah, he was an anonymous selection. La Russa was. I'm looking at the numbers right now. 100% of the vote on the expansionary committee is what it's technically called, because the players all got on the regular ballot that you hear about, and then there's the committees that during the winter meetings meet and will decide. They have a little ballot of managers and older players and stuff that they decide on. So that's pretty amazing, too, that he got 100%. But yeah, 3-time world champion, 4-time manager of the year. His number retired. He's in the Cardinals Hall of Fame, and now he gets his spot in Cooperstown.
All right. Like we mentioned earlier in the show, the MLB trade deadline is coming up in a couple of days here, and perfect lead-in from what we were previously talking about with that Hall of Fame inductions of the 2014 class. Now we'll get a chance to hear from Nick about some of his opinions on a trade that the hometown team, the Detroit Tigers, could make to improve their bullpen, or maybe get another starter to improve their team down the stretch. And we'll also get to hear about some of the prospects and what he thinks they could be future Hall of Famers themselves.
Well, I don't think we have any for sure future Hall of Famers, but the Tigers also didn't know that when they traded John Smoltz for Doyle Alexander back in 87, but who knows, you never know. But going through the list, there's a lot of players who could be on the market, but a lot has happened in the MLB in the past month where a lot of tables have turned. The Rays are no longer in the cellar of basically baseball, and they might not necessarily be sellers, because we all know that the Tampa Bay Rays can make a move in the last 2 months of the year. So that might take David Price and Ben Zobrist right off the market. And that, those are two guys who could help a lot of teams. But it looks like the Red Sox might take the Rays' place in being sellers, and John Lester might be the big pitcher that goes. But I wouldn't expect the Tigers to get any of those guys. It looks like they're going to get a reliever if they get anybody. Maybe a bat. But it doesn't really look like they're going to get a bat. Hopefully Andy Dirks can come back is what they're hoping on. But to go through the Tigers' prospects is what I want to do. MLB.com just re-ranked their list of the top 20 Tigers' prospects. I'm just going to quickly go through them and explain what guys can be traded and what guys can or won't. Some guys are actually, there's no legal way you could trade them because they were just drafted this year. And that's the case with the first prospect, who is Derek Hill, the Tigers' first-round pick this year. He got bumped all the way up to their first prospect already without ever playing a game above rookie ball, but he can't be traded, and the Tigers obviously want to keep him because he's going to be their prized possession. Their number two prospect, which I don't agree with, but I'm not here to argue their rankings. I'm just going to go through the guys and say whether or not I trade them or whether or not we expect them to be traded, is Robbie Ray. Ray was acquired from Washington. He was the headliner of the Fister deal, and he started off really good and even made 3 pretty good spot starts altogether for the Tigers in the early part of the year. But he's starting to struggle a little bit at Toledo, but there's no way he gets traded. Now, if the Tigers are really going to go big and get somebody more than like a middle reliever or platoon bat, then they're probably going to have to part with Willy Adames, who has pretty much held his own. He hasn't been anything like out of the ordinary, but he's held his own in A-ball this year, which is pretty impressive considering that he is only not even 2 years older than me, and I'm going into my senior year at high school. But the kid is only 18 still. He's not even turned 19 yet, and he's hitting .270 at A-ball. It's pretty impressive. And he's showing a little bit of power even. He has 12 triples too, and 14 doubles and 6 homers. So the guy's got 32 extra base hits. So that's his big calling card. But I don't see him trading. I don't want to trade him. Or I don't see him being traded, rather. And I really don't want to trade him because it's pretty cool that the Tigers have a good shortstop prospect who could come up along with Iglesias and Suarez. And it's funny because the Tigers really didn't have many shortstop prospects a few years ago, but that works out good for him. But like I said, Adames will most likely remain a Tiger beyond July 31st, just in a few hours, basically. Not that long until a trading deadline. But Jonathan Crawford has a .299 ERA in West Michigan. Started the All-Star game down there. which I was actually at. He looks, you know, pretty good, but he's nothing impressive, and I could see him not even maybe staying in the rotation as a major leaguer. I think he's definitely the guy to trade and the guy to be traded if they want to get a higher-end reliever. They might not even have to go as far as to part with him, but I actually think West Michigan has a really good starting rotation. They sport Crawford, Kevin Zolmiak, Buck Farmer, and Austin Kubica. And I'm not great on all the pronunciations, so I apologize if any of the players were ever to tune in if we ever be that lucky if I mispronounce your name a little bit. But I think Crawford's actually not even the best out of that bunch. I like Zolmiak, and Kubica's pretty impressive too. I think Crawford's really the third best pitcher down there, so I wouldn't have a problem with them trading him. And then it moves into number five prospects, Devon Travis. He had a really great 2013 between West Michigan and Lakeland, and this year that he got promoted to Erie and got hurt, but he started to, he had a little bit of a slow start once he came back, but he's starting to come back to life. He has 7 homers, 11 stolen bases, hitting almost 300. And I almost think he's too good to trade at this point. The guy's never been really like a top prospect, but he just keeps hitting at every level he goes to, so I'd be a little bit reluctant to trade him, but it's possible. Kevin Zolmiak, who I think's like Drew Smiley, basically, because he's left-handed, so he kind of reminds me of him because he's had fast progress in the system, and he's left-handed. He only has a 2.17 ERA down there, so I really don't want him to be traded, but if the Tigers are high on Crawford, then he might be the guy to go. And then that brings us to Kubica, who's the 7th overall prospect, 2.59 ERA, and he's striking out more than a guy in an inning. So I don't think he'll come up in trade talks if the Tigers will keep him. The Tigers' most interesting trade piece at number 8, though, is Steven Moya. Doesn't have the best hitting tool. He probably won't hit like more than 250, 260 in a full season at the majors. He might actually pan out as a platoon player there. But the dude has power. 26 homers. He's massive. I got to see him play in West Michigan more than once. And he can crush a baseball. So he will be pretty intriguing for some teams. But he may not be the only guy who gets traded if the Tigers get a decent middle reliever. But I could see him going. I like Moya, but if it means winning the World Series, he's definitely a guy that can go because he's not going to be a Hall of Famer in the majors. That brings us to Buck Farmer, who I mentioned earlier. He has a 2.60 ERA down there, and he's the most impressive strikeout artist, I think, out of all the guys down in West Michigan, their impressive rotation. I don't see him going anywhere. There's four guys that are basically better than him down there, and if he's only the fourth best guy on his minor league team, then for the fourth best pitcher, I don't really see a team trading him for him. And then 10's Domingo Leyva, but he's too young to get traded, I think. He's only playing in Connecticut, and he was international signing. He hasn't been that impressive. But if a team wants to take a chance on an international guy, that might be it. Hernan Perez, the guy that looks decent. He looks like he could be a helpful guy in the major league roster, but he kind of got forgotten now that Suarez is up, and like I said, we got a shortstop climbing up the ranks that's really young at MS, and we have Iglesias who's hurt, so I don't think there's any use for Perez, because even if there's an injury or something, we've got a little bit of depth down there now, so I could see him going in a lot of trades, so he's probably the most likely guy that I've mentioned to be traded. Okay, now that he's the 11th best, there's some guys down here. Jose Valdez is not having that great of a year. Melvin Mercedes, they're 12 and 17th respectively on the list. I don't see them getting traded. Tyler Collins, I really thought was going to be pretty good, but he just hasn't hit as well as he did in 2012. He's had power, but he's gained some power, but he's lost some of the average, so his trade stock kind of gets hit there. But maybe if you package Collins and Perez, you can get Antonio Bastardo, who hasn't been that impressive. But we'll hit on the left-handed reliever that I want more in a minute, because it's looking like the Tigers will get a left-handed reliever. Drew Verhagen got a spot start in Detroit, but he's on the 7-day DL, so he's not going anywhere. He gets another year with us. James McCann isn't going anywhere because he's going to overtake Brian Holiday pretty soon. Spencer Turnbull, he just got drafted. He can't go anywhere. Grayson Griner got drafted, who is really impressive, by the way. He's a catcher, really tall catcher, 6'6", but he's not going anywhere.
Angel Nesbitt, I like him. He's probably not going to go anywhere. He's a reliever working his way up. And then at 20, we have Andrés Briseño, which I know I pronounced that wrong probably right now. But he only made 3 starts, and he's been hurt all year for Lakeland, so he's not going anywhere. So it's looking like maybe Hernán Pérez and like Tyler Collins or maybe someone. I don't even think the Tigers like to part with the top 10 prospects if they want to get Bastardo, because Bastardo hasn't been that impressive lately. The guy I want, though, is Andrew Miller. He used to be with the Tigers. He got traded in the Miguel Cabrera trade, but he's never worked out as a starter, and he was definitely a bust for where they took him in the draft, the Tigers did, but they got Miguel Cabrera, so I think they're happy with how that all ended up. But they could get him back, and he could be a good left-hander reliever, better than Culk, better than Kroll. If the Tigers get a reliever, it looks like it needs to be a left-hander, because if not, there's Chad Qualls, there's some other quality guys out there. I don't think the Tigers get anybody big, because Soria is kind of a big-name guy that they already got. So, like I said, Andrew Miller seems like the best option to me, but the Tigers seem pretty set on Bastardo. So, I mean, if I had to say the most likely guy to be acquired by the Tigers in the next couple of days, it's probably going to be Antonio Bastardo. But there's a lot of lefties out there. Tony Sipp is another one. I think I mentioned him. And then Miller, of course, I like. So we'll just see what happens with that. But I think Miller is the guy to go for through the Tigers. And it might require, like, maybe a Steven Moya and Hernán Pérez, maybe a Tyler Collins and Hernán Pérez, but maybe a teeny bit more. But I don't think it'll be anything that bad. And I think the Tigers had a good draft in 2014. It looks pretty good. A lot of the guys perform. And I think they can afford to trade the prospects. I think it'll work out. So, hoping for Miller, but expecting Bastardo. Bastardo could do good with the Tigers. We'll just see how it all goes. But I really hope they get a guy who can just yell. Because we don't want a guy like we got last year with the Bears who just didn't really work out here. And I think Soria is already going to make the deadline. But, you know, we want 2 guys. Dombrowski's always gotten 2 guys that have made an impact on our roster every trading deadline. Varus and Iglesias both did, even though Varus's was very minimal, like I said, last year. In 2012, it was Infante and Sanchez. We got them in the same trade, which looks like a good trade for us now. In 2011, it was Pfister and Delman Young and Wilson Bedement. Like I mentioned in the beginning, you know, 2010, Tigers weren't in it, but they got Peralta. So this is that impact guy, I guess, and I think Soria's going to be the big impact, but we need a little punch in there, too. I would never put it past Dombrowski to make a August trade, even though it only happened in 2011. You never know. It's just whatever helps your club, and if a guy on waivers really sticks out and to the Tigers, and wow, this guy can help us. I don't put it past Dombrowski to make a trade, because I think he will do it, and he can make a lot of good trades. He's made a lot of good trades to his few bad trades that I can think of. There's, you know, everybody makes bad trades, but I think the Soria trade was really good. Jake Thompson's going to be good, but Soria's going to help us win a World Series, hopefully, and that's worth it. But if you win the World Series this year, as long as you're not giving up, I don't think there's a John Smoltz in the system right now. So, you know, just give up some prospects that might have a little bit of an impact for a guy who can give an impact this year. Seems pretty fair for the Tigers. Fair deal. So, you know, they'll probably come out on the winning end of it, because 70-80% of the time they do with Dombrowski, which is, I think, a pretty good rate. So,
yeah, and there are some, you know, there's a lot of critics. A lot of critics have criticized Dave Dombrowski for, you know, the Pfister,
Pfister. Well, he deserves the criticism, yeah, there, because it was a horrible trade, I think.
Yeah, but
I still love him,
but as you mentioned, there's lots of, you know, he has logic behind it. Maybe if Robbie Ray doesn't pan out, then maybe the criticism comes into play a little bit more.
Well, you can never judge a trade until 10 years after. It might look good right after a year. Like, the Edwin Jackson deal looked good for the Tigers after a year. Just from the standpoint of Edwin Jackson versus Matt Joyce. Matt Joyce was in the minors, and Edwin Jackson had a really good year with us. And it ended up being a good trade for us, because we basically turned Matt Joyce into Max Scherzer. But Edwin Jackson has never really repeated his 2009 season. Matt Joyce has probably, I would say, been just as valuable, if not more, to his club as Edwin Jackson has. Edwin Jackson had a good year, I think, in 2012, but he's bounced around, and Matt Joyce, the Rays, got a pretty good deal. So it might look good after 1 year, the Pfister trade isn't really the Joyce trade, but you can never really judge a trade until way after, because at certain points it seems like certain guys are going to win. Like, another example, Josh Hamilton for Edinson Volquez. Everybody thought that was a really fair trade, like a really good trade, because Volquez just started off on fire for the Reds, and Hamilton finally came into his MVP-type caliber play with the Rangers, and it looked like Volquez might win the Cy Young for a while for the first few months, and that Hamilton might compete for the MVP, but then Volquez kind of fizzled out. So you just have to be patient, and you know, I think everybody just has to be patient, because everybody's quick to criticize and stuff.
Yeah, but in the way I see it, if Robbie Ray doesn't pan out, you know, it, like you said, the good Dombrowski has made great trades. I mean, the good definitely outweighs the bad in my mind.
Yeah, it's no reason to fire him or anything.
No, definitely not. And yeah, so that's, you know, with the trade, he touched on some good points in the trade deadline.
If I had to make
a possible trade,
I'll do something really fun here. If I had to make a bold prediction on a trade here, if I had to think of something really crazy, I'd say David Price to the Cubs. But that's only if the Rays decide to sell, because that would be a surprising deal, because the Cubs are obviously not in it. But the Cubs have the prospects, because we saw what they got in the Samardzija trade. They have embarrassment of riches as far as hitting prospects, and they might as well trade a few of them and get a guy like Price. And I think there's a couple ways you could spin that deal, but if you wanted a very bold, out-there prediction, that probably won't happen, but there's always a possibility, and it kind of makes sense. That's what I'll give
you. That is a bold prediction.
But the biggest player most likely to go is John Lester, like I said, and I think he'll help. And it's interesting, because Lester came out and said he might come back and re-sign with the Red Sox if they trade him, so it'll be really interesting to see how that all plays out. So hopefully it's not a dead trading deadline. Hopefully it's a really alive one, because that's always fun.
Yeah, it definitely makes it more exciting for the fans. And just to touch one last time on David Price, this will be it for this segment, but I don't believe they'll trade him. And like you said, it's a bold prediction. You even mentioned it probably won't happen, but I really hope the Rays don't, because they've been really hot. And
I think they could make a playoff run still.
They've been known to make late runs, and I believe they can.
This offseason might be a better time. They can work on their offense. They've had a tough year, too. Will Myers has gotten hurt, and everything. Longoria's had a down year, kind of. So, you know, just hasn't all been there for him. But it's starting to come together for him, and good for the Rays. They're fun to watch. And if anybody had to win the AL East, I'd hope it'd be the Orioles, Blue Jays, or Rays, because, you know, the Yankees and Red Sox had
one
division, like, pretty much every year besides the two times the Rays have won it.
The Yankees, that's probably the most disliked team in baseball.
And probably the most fun.
Actually, yeah, good point.
They're probably both. Well, when you think of a sport, you got to associate a team with it. Like, MLB is the Yankees. NHL kind of depends on what side of the border you're on, because I think if you're on this side of the border, it'd probably be the Red Wings. But if you're in Canada, you're probably going to say the Maple 20 Leafs.
20-plus straight years.
Yeah, you're probably going to say the Maple Leafs or someone. Maple Leafs or Canadians would be the two.
Yeah.
And then, but like football, you got the Cowboys. And then,
America's
team. Yeah, well, not my team, but the mediocre. The Cowboys have like been 500, I think, since 1997. If you add up all their record, they've been exactly 500. So, but, and then the NBA, you got the Celtics and the Lakers that you can associate with. So every sport needs that team. So, you know, we'll see what happens. The AL East will probably be the most exciting race besides the NL Central down the wire, even though the Orioles have taken a little bit of a lead. But we'll get more into the pennant races a little bit after the trading deadline, because we have to see how all the moves pan out. So we'll move on, though, to in a minute here to the NFL talk with Austin, because he is pretty pumped up. I'm pretty pumped up, too, to play some fantasy football and lose, because I'm horrible at it. Fantasy baseball. It's my thing. So we'll see what happens, but All right.
So for our third and final main segment of this podcast, I decided to talk about the NFL training camps. The preseason starts next week, and I'd like to touch on four four. I'm going to touch on mainly four teams today. One of them is going to be, the first one is going to be Super Bowl champions, Seattle Seahawks. Yesterday they kicked off their Super Bowl title defense with the first day of their training camp. You know, the main guys, Russell Wilson, the quarterback, he's reported. From what I've read and heard, they made some pretty impressive plays at their training camp today. Russell Wilson, the starter especially. But the big story with them comes in the running back department. Marshawn Lynch, he's holding out for a new contract.
He asked in a funny way, too, didn't he? Like, didn't he tell, like, he called, like, an NFL Network analyst that used to be his teammate and told him, I'm pretty sure. I read something about that.
Yeah. That's funny. Well, the big thing is here, he considers himself an elite running back, and I do, too. He's a great, great, great touch for the Super Bowl champions, and they might have not won without him. But this leading into the training camp, backups Robert Turbin got a lot of carries today. Well, and
they're going to be lost in the running back department without him. He's head and shoulders above Turbin.
Yes, definitely. So, I mean, I think he'll end up coming back, even if he doesn't get the extreme contract he wants, just because if you miss preseason games, you start losing out on regular season paychecks. That's one of the penalties.
We'll see if he's kind of a more of a prima donna guy like Chad Johnson, or maybe a guy who's more concerned about winning. We'll see when the preseason games start, because we don't really know. He's got an interesting personality with the beast mode and everything, but
yeah,
see, he's kind of more of a laid back guy though. Jay Johnson's more outspoken. Marshawn Lynch is more quiet and doesn't like. He doesn't like to be bothered by the media because he left media day early, didn't he?
Yeah,
like, I remember that. Yeah.
The wide receivers, you know, they're all back. Percy Harvin, he's just an explosive guy. He makes great plays. He's not as big as Calvin Johnson, and don't get me wrong, I'm definitely not comparing him, but he just reminds me of the huge explosive plays he makes. He makes huge plays for that team. And big point, Madden cover athlete this year, Richard Sherman, the whole Legion of Boom is back, so he'll help them hold down the secondary, along with big, huge safety Cam Chancellor, and that should be all right.
Let me ask you this: do you think the Seahawks have the best chance to repeat as champions, like more than any other team in the past few years in the NFL? I think they're the best returning defending champion team.
I'd say so. Russell Wilson's only getting better.
Well, they're pretty young on that part of the ball. I mean, Marshall
Lynch
is a vet, but
and you know. Yeah. The best crowd in football. So, I'd like to move on to the, you guys may not know, but I'm a huge fan of Robert Griffin III. I really like what they did with Baylor.
Former Baylor Bear, baby.
Baylor Bear. And, yeah, I'm a big fan of RG3. And he's been looking really good in training camp. He got hurt a couple years ago. Messed up his knee pretty bad, and as his rookie season, he had a great year. He hurt his knee, came back his first sophomore season, did not do as well. He definitely had a down year. Started to worry some people, but I think a big thing of it, he wasn't fully healed. They've said that, I said that he wasn't fully healed yet. And this year, all the off-season workouts, he hasn't been wearing that big bulky knee brace he was wearing last season. So I think we're definitely going to see him return to his old self and gain a lot more mobility back and start playing like the RG3 we've seen at Baylor.
Well, even if he needs to, like, say he has a game where it's tough on his leg, I think Kirk Cousins is a pretty good backup to have around.
Oh yeah, definitely. He showed he showed showed he's capable.
Yeah, I mean, granted, he's not as good as RG3 or as a talent, but he's not going to bring the same style of game, obviously, but he's got a pretty good arm on him, pretty smart player. He's a pretty capable quarterback. He could probably start in 5-6 teams in the NFL, and we haven't even seen, what he fully can do.
And another thing with that, the Redskins' new head coach, Jay Gruden, I think he's going to do a great job with the quarterbacks. Like you said, if RG3 hurts himself again or even just needs a week off, to prevent the re-injury, I think Jay Gruden's been doing a great job trying to progress Cousins and, make the playbook fit both quarterbacks. Get some packages in there where they both can get reps, especially in the training camp and preseason. The next couple quick little touches on two teams. First, the New England Patriots, Rob Gronkowski. I watched an interview with him. It was a SportsCenter interview. And he did say he's not feeling quite 100% yet, but he seemed very, very determined to come back and help his teammates. And his teammates are helping him get back to where he was a couple years ago. And, I've always been a big fan of tight ends. I think they can change an offense drastically. And
I can tell because you like the Ebron pick.
Yeah.
We'll
touch on that a little bit later.
Yeah.
I love tight ends, and if he can come back, that'd be huge for Tom Brady and the Patriots, because, like I said, I think he can do a lot of damage at tight end, and it'd be another big target. He's a great player, but if he's not 100%, then...
Do you think he could ever be better than Jimmy Graham is at this point?
Well, they're a little bit different players.
Yeah, but just like, say it's fantasy football.
Fantasy football?
Just for fantasy football, I guess.
I'm taking Gronk.
You think so? Yeah, he's hurt. He's been hurt, so it's hard to, Jimmy Graham's number one right now, but just as far as stat-wise, I guess, is what I was asking, yeah.
I'm taking Gronk. More touchdowns, more targets.
And then on the blocking end of things, you like Gremlin, is what you're saying? Like,
yeah.
All right. Both big guys.
Graham's caught his fair share of touchdown passes, but, I mean, he's a terrific run blocker, too. He's just a big guy.
Yeah.
And then, the biggest story of the draft was Johnny Manziel.
Well, you seem to like guys with personalities, because you like Gronk, so what's your opinion on Manziel?
Exactly the opposite.
Well, you don't like him, but it's not because of personality, right? It's because more of his abilities, right? That's what you're saying? Are you saying
his abilities, huh?
You think you don't like his abilities? As far as translating...
What huge abilities are you referring to?
Well, I mean, I'm asking you because I want to hear your opinion on it here.
Okay, I think he does...
What he can hit.
He's a great football player, but he's kind of... From the tape I've seen on him, he's selfish. He's definitely more selfish.
Of a college quarterback, better fit.
Definitely more of a college quarterback. I've always said that college is a whole different level from the NFL. When you reach the NFL, it's a whole different game. You have to be a learner from the coaches and the veteran quarterbacks. And from the tape I've seen on Manziel in training camp, especially. In training camp, but especially in college, he's a little bit greedy. The stat book, we've seen him pass up open receivers. We've seen him, he's just a cocky little guy on the field. He likes the spotlight, which is nothing wrong with liking the spotlight, but when it's affecting your team and your team's performance,
think you could ever change that? And do you think that would make him a better player for you?
He's gonna have to change it. He was a first round pick.
Yeah.
He otherwise.
He's got no receivers to throw to now, too. So it might be disappointing. Who do you think marches out there on the first game, though? Him or Hoyer?
Because, game day?
Yeah, first game of the year for the Browns. Who do you think's starting quarterback, him or Hoyer?
Hoyer.
You think so?
Brian
when
Hoyer.
Do you think Manziel starts his first game this year? What week, if you had to give a number? Like, what game number?
Well, Hoyer was 3-0 before his injury.
So you don't even think Manziel's going to start this year? Do you think Hoyer leads the Browns to the playoffs? Manziel.
The playoffs?
Manziel. If Manziel never gets a chance. Well, I think if the Browns get eliminated, they'll give Manziel a little bit of a look. Even if
Hoyer goes down with another injury, or if he's having an absolute drastic year, Manziel gets a shot. But otherwise, I'm thinking with the new leadership over there, my personal prediction is he doesn't get a shot. Like I said, unless Hoyer's injured, or they're having a drastic season, because I think he needs to be put in his place.
Okay, so let's just say the Browns are at a point where they're 5-9. You don't think they give Manziel the two last starts of the year just to see what he does?
I don't think so. Because, like I said, Hoyer's a veteran, and Manziel needs to be put in his place a little bit and know that he is the backup, and he needs...
All right, so you're getting a little bit of Aaron Rodgers treatment almost, except Brett Favre's not free, it's Brian Hoyer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a little bit of a difference, but...
Yeah.
Like I said, but my prediction, Hoyer, week one.
Okay, that makes sense. I agree with that, probably.
And, aside from all that, I'd like to touch on the hometown Lions a little bit.
All right, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Big fan of the new coaching staff. Jim Caldwell... I'm not predicting a Super Bowl or anything, but, you know, he was a quarterback's coach from 2009 to 2013 with two different teams. Until 2011, he coached for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He was quarterback coach with Josh Freeman, who kind of went downhill a little bit. And I'm sure he coached up Mike Glennon, who looks like he's going to be the starter in Tampa Bay this year. And then he was the quarterback's coach for the Indianapolis Colts. Andrew Luck was a terrific quarterback coming out of college. And I think he's a terrific quarterback in the NFL. He reminds me a lot of Matt Stafford. And for that reason, I think that Caldwell can come into Detroit and help with Stafford, help develop him to his true potential.
Yeah, I think Stafford needs to make smarter throws from watching the games. I'm no expert on football. Baseball is more of my sport, but, you know, I can watch football, and I think Stafford just made a lot of dumb decisions last year. Like, I remember they were playing the Giants, and he threw an interception that was totally unnecessary, and it pretty much closed the book on the Lions. Well, it did, because they got eliminated. The Lions had, if they would have won that game, they probably would have made the playoffs, and he made a stupid throw at... And it was the fourth quarter. They just needed to run the clock out. He made just a stupid throw, and it got intercepted. Just the fact that they decided to throw it, I don't know if it was him or the coaching staff, but yes. He just needs a little bit of a wake-up call. And I think that he has talent. It's all there. I mean, you just got to unleash the talent, you know? You gotta let it
reach your full potential. Like you said, the coaching staff, that leads me to my next point. The Lions' new offensive coordinator, Joe Lombardi. He served as an offensive assistant / quarterback's coach with the New Orleans Saints from 2009 to the end of 2014 before Jim Caldwell brought him in to be the offensive coordinator of the Lions. But, like I said, the Saints, they were a good team for many years. Drew Brees, Joe Lombardi had a huge part in Drew Brees. He was already a mature quarterback, but I believe Joe Lombardi brought him to the next level, and I'm very, very confident that he can turn Stafford's game around, and along with Jim Caldwell, help him reach his true potential. But, you know, that's only one side of the ball. That's offense. But
there's no secondary.
But a main problem that all of us have seen is that the Lions' secondary is very lacking. for many years now. We've drafted.
It's still never drafted.
We've drafted linemen. We've drafted
wide receivers.
Wide receivers.
Quarterback.
This year we drafted a tight end. I personally am okay with that pick because Eric Ebron is drawing comparisons to guys like Jimmy Graham and Antonio Gates. I mean, if you think of great tight ends, those are the top two I can think of my generation.
Well, I just think they should have taken a corner. Because they have... Okay, the thing that made no sense to me was don't re-sign Pettigrew. Let Pettigrew walk. You have Fourier who can rotate Fourier and Ebron. So the first thing I wouldn't have done is I wouldn't have signed Pettigrew again.
And then, for that money.
And then we have three good tight ends and a bunch of great targets for Stafford with Golden Tate now too. And
yeah, Golden Tate was a great addition.
Yeah. So he has a bunch of targets, and Reggie Bush is a multi-purpose threat. And he can return, run, catch passes. But the thing is that the Lions needed a corner. And I know Ebron, to them, Austin just explained that, he might be a once-in-a-lifetime talent or a once-in-every-10-years, 20-years talent that you grab on the board. But I would have drafted a corner because you just need it. And there were a lot of good corners available, too. And you just needed an elite corner. And, I mean, I wanted Denard. Because, of course, I got to see him play on a Michigan State game. But really, any good corner would have done. There's a lot of good corners on the board that I think the Lions could have nabbed in the first round of the draft.
Yeah.
But we'll have to see what happens. Maybe this year they go out and make a deal at some point in the year for a corner if they're contending. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, from what I hear, Darius Slay, he's looking really good in camp. He's driving through receivers, jarring the ball loose. But then again, that's just camp. Sometimes it doesn't show when you get in a game. I don't know if they were going full speed today, but that's just some of the notes. And but that's only one corner. I would have been fine with either pick, but I can see the logic behind the Eric Ebron pick because, he may not be NFL ready. They're saying he is, but if he's not NFL ready, you still need a pass blocker, and that's Pettigrew, or a run blocker. A run blocker in Pettigrew, but Pettigrew's been known for dropping passes, and then we got Big Joe Fourier, to catch clutch passes in the red zone, and such. Eric Ebron is going to be an excellent run blocker. That's what he's known for. His hands, mediocre hands as of right now, but they can work on that. But I can understand both picks. I would have been perfectly fine if they drafted a corner because that's what we needed for many years.
Yeah, we'll have to see how it plays out. Maybe you'll be right. Probably have a better chance of me being right.
Did you have anything last things to say about the training camps?
No, I'm just excited to see some. Football, and I hope Stafford has a good year and becomes at least a top 10 quarterback. And as far as speaking on the Lions, is that I think they have the talent here to win at least 10 games and at least be a wild card team, maybe with this weaker division win the division, and not necessarily Super Bowl this year, but we just want to see progress. So we definitely want to see at least above 500 season here. And hopefully Caldwell can deliver. So we'll have to see, though, because you never know what to expect with the Lions. Thanks for listening to our podcast tonight.